I made a promise that I wouldn't turn on the mic until the last note of the song had faded away. Hello, everybody.
Hello.
Good song choice, When I Am Frightened.
Yes.
You know, I write a blog called The Lively Tradition, which is a slight play on words because we always call ourselves the living tradition, but what good is it if it's merely alive and not lively? So, and what I blog about, people know what a blog is, right? It's, you know, a guy in his pajamas writing on his computer at home. What I blog about is mostly Unitarian Universalist public theology. That space where our theology intersects with what's going on in the world, the real world. And my starting point is that theology and religion are public subjects. They're made by people in society, and they're responses to what is going on in the world at the time. So I'm interested in questions like, how did the founding of the UUA in 1961 fit with the election of John Kennedy and the Southern Civil Rights Movement? I'm interested in questions like, why on earth did we decide to write down our seven principles in the middle of the Reagan administration? And conversely, what do our UU theologies say to us about the world we face today? And this world that we live in, with its grotesque economic inequality and cataclysmic climate change, how does our theological tradition respond? So when approaching Channing's Baltimore sermon, which is actually quite important in my own life, but that's another story. When approaching Channing's Baltimore sermon, I asked myself the question, how is this a statement of its time? Why was it given in 1819? I'm less interested in Channing's thoughts on how to read the Bible or the main points of Christian doctrine than I am interested in what was going on in public thought those days that would make this sermon important. In 1819, engaged people were still influenced intellectually by the American Revolution. The Revolutionary War had ended in 1781, the Constitution in 1789, ratified 32 years later. The Revolution was closer to Channing than the radicalisms of the 60s and 70s are to us. Now, the American Revolution saw the emergence of a new political ideology, republicanism. I think we've all heard of it. But not that republicanism. Republicanism at that point was against the system of aristocracy. European society was traditionally governed by a titled nobility, aristocrats. They were Lord this and Lady that and Duke of something or other. You've all seen Downton Abbey, right? And the American colonial revolutionaries rejected that whole system. They believed that all men were created equal. Not in any sense that we conceive of equality, but they rejected as just not true that there was some subspecies of humanity that by birth was entitled to wealth and power. Indeed, one of the most far-reaching and significant provisions of the Constitution in 1789 was that it expressly forbid the granting of titles and nobility to American citizens by either the federal or any of the state governments. And no American citizen could accept a foreign title of nobility from any without the permission of Congress. They had set a barrier against the English throne or the French from setting up an American nobility. This was Republican political theory. They did not believe in equality as we know it, but they resisted and ended aristocracy. It doesn't seem radical to us now. We think the fact that Paul McCartney is Sir Paul McCartney is kind of cute, but we don't give him a house in Congress, a seat in Congress. Now, I believe that that Republican political theory helped cause the intellectual collapse of Puritan Calvinism in the New World. I think this is hard to trace because theologians never admit when they're writing that they're responding to events in the world. They always write as though they just discovered something new in the Bible, but they're really responding to what's going on in the world. But consider this. Calvinism, of course, you know, is a system which has as its heart the predestination of an elect that was chosen to go to heaven before the world was created, while the rest of us head for hell. Now you ask, why? What was the theological justification for such a system? And the Calvinists would say, it's because that's the way God made it. That's all we need to know. God chose some people to go to heaven and the rest of us to go to hell. And that's the way God made it. And the test of our faith is whether or not we can accept that as God's will. It's the same theological justification for why there's an aristocracy. God made them that way. And it's a test of our good citizenship that we recognize the quality of our betters. Same logic. Slowly, and we all know this story, the standing order clergy of New England fell away from Calvinism and its theory of the preordained elect and the corresponding theory of the utter depravity of humanity. As this radical republicanism seeped into theological consciousness, it started a whole process of deconstructing the Calvinist consensus. And if we've read our Conrad Wright, we know how each domino fell. If we're not all condemned, then we don't need to be saved. If we don't need to be saved, we don't need a savior. And if we don't need a savior, then Jesus doesn't have to be divine. But the core issue was, what makes more sense? What's more moral? That God draws these arbitrary distinctions in this life and in the next? Or that each of us has within us the potential for great things? And if we can see the fundamental equality of all humanity, how can we be wiser and more moral than God? So my suspicion is that the 18th century Boston theologians were applying the political theory of American republicanism, the revolutionary republicanism of 1776, to theology. Now, every period of creativity, of creative liberalism, of progressiveness, every revolution brings about its own counter-revolution. In 1805, the Orthodox Calvinists struck back against this emerging liberal theology, and they opened up an aggressive campaign against the liberals. They would not exchange pulpits, they would not enter into common organizations. They made up theological tests to be applied to the selection of professors at Harvard. It was a typical attack by conservatives against liberals. Liberals are too permissive. Liberals are undermining long-standing traditions. Liberals are questioning eternal truths. Liberals will bring about the downfall of society by questioning these truths. They are no longer Christian. And the typical conservative attacks was met by the typical liberal response. Face it, We're just shocked that anybody could be so mean. But we're not doing anything wrong. We're just thinking thoughts. We're just saying some things that seem to be obviously true. They're so mean. Why can't we all just get along? But in 1819, here in this room in Baltimore, William Ellery Channing flipped the script on the conservatives and wrote a new story. He said to the conservatives, "You call us Unitarians, like that's a bad thing." He said to the conservatives, "You say we read the Bible relying on reason, like that's a bad thing and that you don't do it too. You say that God's too loving, our idea of God is too loving, like that's a bad thing." He stood up to the charge that liberals had a watered down and deficient form of Christianity. He flipped the script and argued that Unitarian Christianity was more true, more soundly based on the biblical record, and more in the spirit of original Christianity than our Calvinist opponents. And he was not afraid to call them opponents. He argued, in fact, that liberal Christianity was pure and simple Christianity. Now, do single sermons change the course of history? My preaching colleagues and I all hope that it does. Rarely it happens. But it is true that when Channing flipped the script and wrote a new story, what followed was the golden age of Unitarianism. The next few decades, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, Unitarianism moved with confidence, growing, planting new churches, converting churches, creating new institutions, spawning new religious and philosophical traditions and movements, nurturing thinkers, writers, poets, authors. Channing himself became one of the leading spiritual voices of his day. His Unitarian Christianity pamphlet I just read the other day was the second most widely published pamphlet in America after Thomas Paine's Common Sense. And Unitarianism had a profound impact on the social order. Flipping the script. Writing a new story, going from defense to offense, going from being apologetic to being self-confident. I believe the time has come for Unitarian Universalism to flip the script in contemporary American religious culture. Let's talk about this moment. This historical moment. Unitarian Universalism was founded in 1961. At that time, it seemed that we were a religion made for the age. It was a new, fresh interpretation of older traditions that seemed to be in tune with the optimistic liberalism that was personified by John Kennedy, a torch has passed to a new generation. We were tested and challenged, and we responded well to the civil rights movement in the South. It was a heady time for us. And the 60s were a time of, the early 60s were a time of growth and vitality for this new religion. We were in tune with this culture, with the ascendant liberalism of the culture, and we were filled with hope and confidence. But in less than a decade, the tide turned. Every revolution has its own counter-revolution. Conservative politicians and theoreticians and theologians found a way to knit together all the strands of discontent and uncomfort with the changes going on and to fashion them into a conservative majority. And just as in the post-Revolutionary War world in which William Ellery Channing worked, conservatives began a campaign to demonize all forms of liberalism in American culture. One of their leading lights said, "We intend to make liberalism a dirty word." And for much of the time, and in much of the culture, they succeeded. And their critique of liberalism was simple. Liberalism is too permissive. It has a naive view of human nature, and as a result, fails to understand just how evil and committed to evil or demonic means committed to evil, some people are. We, liberals, did not grasp the danger that the demonic posed to all of us. So where we saw the condition of poverty, they saw the sin of laziness. Where we saw the circumstance of an unwanted pregnancy, they saw the just punishment for lust. Where we saw the cruel stigmatization of gays and lesbians, they saw perverts demanding sexual license. Where we saw poor people crossing borders to work, they saw greed and theft. Conservatives, whether political, economic, social, or religious, believe that our problems come from people with bad intentions conducting bad behavior, from sin. And liberals, in their eyes, aid and abet the sinful. Our permissiveness just makes everything worse. So their work is to forcefully point out to us and to everyone just how evil some people are, in the hope that we will stop trying to help them. And the result is, bottom line, the conservative cultural project is to demonize people. I'll say that again, because I mean it quite literally. The signature gesture of modern conservatism is to demonize, to assign to someone evil intention, and to blame them for what goes wrong. And we liberals have been demonized as well. We were made into jokes. We were latte sipping, Chardonnay drinking, cheese and cracker eating, Prius driving, politically correct, faddish, overly privileged, romantic, radical chic, tree hugging, dirt worshiping, Birkenstock wearing, unattractive, bra-burning, hairy-legged lesbian and limp-wristed fags, tax and spending liberals, draft-dodging, dope-smoking liberals, and UU churches were full of them. And can I say this? I've been around this movement for now, you know, most of my life, but as an adult, since 1989, every Unitarian Universalist I know has absorbed this toxic message and internalized it to some degree or another. We have allowed a self-hatred to grow up in our hearts. Just notice how much contempt we shower on each other in our churches, in our wider denomination, and in anyone who attempts to assert leadership among us. Notice how easily we accuse each other of bad intentions. We accuse each other of gross hypocrisy. Oh, he talks the talk, but he doesn't walk the walk. Oh, that person's just into checkbook activism. Now, the reason why I want you to understand this, the reason why I think we talk like this about each other, is not because we're morally deficient people, it's because for our whole lives, and for the lives of almost everyone who's an adult in this room, we have been part of a cultural population that has been ridiculed, vilified, demonized, but mostly ridiculed, mocked, minimized, and made a joke of. For most of us in this room, that has been our experience, to be a religious leader in a religious movement that feels like it's in exile, that feels like a saving remnant rather than a vanguard, where our churches feel like refuges and havens rather than launching pads. For my entire adult life, Unitarian Universalists have been obsessed with one question: what's wrong with us? There must be something wrong with us. They're building giant mega churches and we're struggling to hang on. There must be something wrong with us. There must be something wrong with us, because we talk about building a golden city, and yet the cities we live in have not been transformed. There must be something wrong with us. Whatever we've accomplished, it's not enough. Whatever we've accomplished, the fact that it's not enough makes us into hypocrites for having accomplished it. It's time to flip that script. It's time to go from being hunkered down and defensive to being clear and forthright. It's time to state our purposes and goals and to make clear the distinctions that separate us from our opponents. And like Channing, I'm not afraid to call them our opponents. If the mark of conservative theology and politics is demonization, the purpose of liberal theology and politics is humanization. Unitarian Universalism's message and mission is to rehumanize this culture. Rehumanize. Say it all with me. We're going to make this culture human again. We're going to rehumanize this culture. We're not looking for a safe corner where we can be left alone. We're not content with forming loving communities of like-minded people. It's not enough for us to be a little nicer to visitors and to be more welcoming to the people who make their way to our doors. No, our purpose is to rehumanize this culture, to bring back to the center the human being, those images of God, each one worthy, each one caught up in a web of mutuality, so that we cannot understand anything that someone does. We have no right to judge anything that anyone does until we understand how that happened. Is that, I'm looking like it's... I blew it out. Okay. Are we doing? Oh, this thing probably fell off. Hang in there. I'm kicking up hard here, and now it goes good on me. I got it. We're good. We're good. Thank you for letting me know that. Can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Where was I? What was I ranting and raving about now? Our purpose is to rehumanize this culture, to bring back to the center of public consciousness the human beings that are involved in everything that we see go on. We can't talk about the ecology and climate change unless we get to ourselves, the people in desertified countries that are living in poverty and drought. We can't understand immigration until we understand that there's people trying to get work and support their family. We have to get back to the concept of that human being, which is the central subject of our thought. We will humanize this culture by calling each other one at a time and calling the whole people to the virtues of liberality, honesty, humility, generosity and gratitude, reverence and awe, openness, solidarity, self-possession. I use that list all the time. You know where I got that list? By looking at that reading we just did, 592. I call that mind free. Read through that reading and ask yourself, what does this call me to be? It's a recipe for a better person than I am, but a person that I can aspire to be. Liberalism and the virtues of liberality are not the problem in this society, they are the solution. These virtues make for happy and healthy people and societies. They are the antibodies that resist the infection of demonization. William Ellery Channing came here to ordain Jared Sparks. Today I ordain you all into a great struggle to detoxify our society, to meet the poisons of demonization with the balm of humanization, to meet dismissal and contempt with solidarity, to meet indifference with generosity, to counter prejudice with openness, to answer judgment with truth and humility, and to contain the contagion of fear and blame with bravery, with reverence for each other, and with self-possession. I ordain you to a gospel of love, to not only believe in love, but to work for the institutionalization of love as the foundation of human civilization. The institutionalization of love as the foundation of our human civilization. I ask you to stand by love's side. And I ask you to preach love more loudly with your lives than with your lips. Amen.